Hello and welcome back to Unseen Incidents. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on this week's episode, we're talking about Jose Mourinho's return to Real Madrid, running through the transfers Los Blancos have made so far, how we expect them to set up under the special one, and whether he is remotely capable of being special anymore. Then we open up the burn book. While over on the paid side, we get into another Madrid story, Vinicius Jr., who could be on his way to Arsenal. Is it possible? What would it take? And what would he bring to the Gunners? Plus, we go through our last few weeks in anything but football. That's all in today's episodes of Unseen Incidents. Pete, we're back. Back for more Unseen Incidents. Man, I'm on it today. I'm like,
fumes.
Do you take medication for ADHD?
No. I raw dog it. I used to. Okay. So I took medication all through child, basically from when I was diagnosed at, like, I don't know, 9 through to about regularly until about 17, sporadically until about 24, post-uni, just raw dogged.
Okay. There are people I know with ADHD who will take their medication from time to time, right? And the medication they're on specifically is like, you know, speed, right?
It's fast acting fucking amphetamines, basically.
Yeah, it's amphetamines. I mean, there are other things, right? You know, like, it always annoys me that people don't get told that there are other, like, pharmaceutical approaches to ADHD.
The teenage one I had was like a really slow building one, so it didn't do anything for 2 weeks, and it built up in your system over time. The other ones were like, no, this is like straight up Ritalin, or a version of Ritalin.
Sure,
take it when you need it.
I find that sometimes when I talk to people with ADHD who do use their medication, you know, from time to time, basically when they need to lock in, it means that, like, you actually cannot take any detours because they're like, no, like, they're just back to the point all the time. Like, it's kind of great.
Yeah.
I realized at one point that a podcast I listened to, like, eventually one of the co-hosts revealed that he had ADHD and that he took his medication, like, sporadically, and I was like, I've been able to tell the episodes where you take your medication because they're a lot more organized.
Yeah.
And then the others are like very discursive. But yes, anyway, today, getting to the point, because I'm running on 2 hours sleep. It's hot as fuck in my loft.
Yeah, it's hot.
But it's been a long while. We haven't been able to get together for a while, so, you know, here we are.
Yeah, no, I must say the I know that you really do treasure your sleep, and you're a big 7-8, like minimum 7, preferably 8 or 9 hour boy a night. But whatever has happened in the last 24 hours, your hair looks disheveled, but in a good way.
Really?
Yeah. I noticed it when I logged on straight away. I was like, it's an interesting kind of, like, it's, you know, in the noughties when, I mean, when I say people, I mean me, would literally spend like 35 minutes with Dax Wax styling their hair. Each individual spike perfectly achieve a look that looked messy and, like, unkempt. So it was like it was the biggest fallacy ever. It was an incredibly well kept messy look. So that kind of hair that looks effortlessly messy. But I know that I'm assuming that this is effortlessly messy.
It is effortless. In fact, before this, like, basically, I had like a really quick shower earlier. You know, like, where I had kind of 5 minutes and I was like, I'm so fucking hot, I need to have another shower. And also because I've had to wash my hair a lot in the last 24 hours because there were nits going around Coco's school.
Oh my God.
And so Emma and I checked each other and we were like, we're both fine. But once you know that there are nits going around, you're like, I might as well just do the treatment. Because when we were kids, I swear it was like a week of combing get out of your hair.
It was horrible, wasn't it?
Now it's literally like one treatment. You put it on your head, it sits for 20 minutes, and then you wash it out. And I guess if you had eggs in your hair, you'd have to comb it out. But like I say, Emma and I didn't have anything in our hair. We were basically just like psychosomatically itching. But the thing is, then it leaves, like, unless you wash your hair with really hot water, which I was not going to do because it was too hot.
Yeah.
Like, it leaves a kind of residue on your hair. So I've been washing it and washing it. And then, yeah, before we got on here, I was like, I might need to put product in it. I didn't put any product in it. But I was like, I might need to put product in it just to get it out of my fucking eyes because, like, it just does what it wants. But, you know, I was said to Emma today, and you must experience this as well, that in the fade days, 2-3 weeks in, you start thinking, when can I justify getting my next haircut? You know, like, when's payday? Can I go? Like, blah, blah, blah.
I was always buying on 3 weeks.
Sure. That's so often. And now I was just like, I feel like I had a haircut pretty recently, but my hair is pretty out of control. You know what? Maybe I will just go and get another one before my birthday next week. Mm. And then I looked at it and I was like, it's been 6.5 weeks since I last got a haircut.
It's a really nice time.
But it just like doesn't get that insane anymore, you know? Or it's kind of, I'm used to it being insane. So that is really nice, actually. It's paying dividends. And, you know, seeing as the hairdresser I go to is, he's fancy. He's a fancy boy. I'm glad that I'm only going every month and a half because this fucker is bleeding me.
When we went to like Champs and when we got skin fades all back in, or you were kind of,
I didn't get skin fade.
You weren't part of this group, but like there was a production line.
I was a 0.5er.
Yeah, there was a production line from Football Daily to Champs Barbers around the corner for about 18 months solid. People would go at lunchtime all the time. Every 3 weeks, everybody would go. And it was £25 haircut, which seemed pretty reasonable at the time, but that's the equivalent of a £50 haircut on your current cadence.
Yeah.
Because it's now your hair's longer and we're waiting 6 weeks. And it's like, okay, well, going to a fancier, more expensive salon, men's grooming type place and looking at it and saying, you know what, £50 for a haircut's pretty steep. It's actually works out the exact same price, pound for pound, than we were paying at Champs in 2017 because we were getting it cut literally three times every 2 months.
I do pay slightly more than £50.
Yes. Well, okay. So
very marginal. Also, you know, I used to, for my old hairdresser, it was a bit less, but I would have to travel there.
Yeah.
You know, and now I can walk to my hairdresser and therefore I count that as part of the savings. That's my boy math on it.
I was paying £50, but those were mate rates from me knowing the owner. But if you remember me now having to change my barber because he's stopping cutting to focus on the business side, he's recommended me a barber in the stable of barbers that he has working for him. And I've noticed that he put it in without the mate rates. So I fear the mate rates are gone.
Oh, no.
Because I previously did get other cuts from other people in the place. A guy called Mikey, who's now since started his own company, but he honoured the unwritten rule.
That's pretty big of him.
Like he looked in the bookings and saw that it was going through. He was like, it's only like, it would be, I don't know, 15% cheaper. But yeah, he saw in the bookings that it was that price for Max. So he honoured that without me even asking. But I've noticed that in the booking system now that it's full price. So I'm now a full price boy.
That's unfortunate. Oh, well. It was good while it lasted. You should say, like, do you not know who I am? Is there a picture of you on their website? I feel like, you know, if they take a picture and they put it on the website, you know, or on the Instagram page, then I'm like, I should get some, like, lasting discount because, like, you're using my image rights.
I do always wonder during haircuts being like, all right, like, is somebody, especially if you're going to a person you've not been cut before or cut by before, which will be the next instance, but a lot of them put stuff on their Instagram and all. And I was like, maybe they're going to ask me, you know, at the end of it, be like, this, you know, this guy's hair is just, you know, phenomenal. I need to get this on the gram. Mm-hmm. And then you see, because the establishment is like now really quite famous and is attracting some like celebrity clientele and all. You see the people that are using for promo and they're just literally fucking male models. It's like Gen Z Henry Cavill's. Slightly leaner, or not leaner, but like slightly like less buff and hench, not quite as big a frame, more slender, but still athletic and just like the classic tall, dark, slightly olive skin, dark brown, black hair that's the proper long slick back and flows everywhere. And you're just like, yeah, you know what? If you're going to choose free publicity, feels like you're making the right choice here.
But they probably don't have a podcast.
They probably don't, no. No.
A smallish podcast.
No, but they probably do
where it's like one of those ones where they're just like, yeah, but like, do you ever feel that like girls like they're moving weird, like sometimes, yeah, like fully, like, yeah, you know, that's probably the kind of podcast I have. You know?
Yeah, whereas like, we contribute so much more to
what Andrew Tate said.
Yeah, I know he makes some really good points. If you actually like think about what he says, Andrew Tate actually has some really valid approaches.
Yeah. Like, it's complicated, but it's good when you think about it.
Yeah, when you're really deep it, Patrick.
When you really deep it, yeah. we're such wankers. Okay, all right. So today we're going to talk about Jose Mourinho going back to Real Madrid. And then we'll get into the burn book. Okay, Mourinho, so This feels like they ran out of people to appoint, right?
Kind of, yeah.
Like, I mean, obviously, it kind of feels like if, say, you know, Nagelsmann had won the World Cup, then maybe we'd have seen that happen. But they wanted to get somebody in before the World Cup, really. And they've made their way through everybody. Like, somebody like Tuchel wasn't going to jump ship at that point. They've tried all the promoting from within and shipped a bunch of those guys out as well. They're not getting Zidane back because Zidane was known to be waiting on the France job. Like, so in the end, it feels like they said, we're going to get a known quantity. I'm using that term.
That's quite, yeah.
How it's not really true, is it? Because, well, you know what he was, but the question is, do you know what he is now? Like, that's kind of the issue with Mourinho, right? Like, that's literally the whole topic of our podcast. But anyway, like, two seasons without a trophy, they obviously think somebody needs to come in to give everybody a kick up the arse. I mean, Ted's kind of theory of this, I think, is quite compelling as well, in that he was like, if Real Madrid do need to do something like sell Vinicius, or if they do need to, you know, bench one of Vinicius and Mbappe until those guys get their shit together and realize they have to defend. Like, if they want to, say, bench Trent Alexander-Arnold just a year after, like, making a massive deal about getting him in the door. Like, if they want to do something like this, if they've got a lot of unpopular shit that they've got to do, getting in a guy who's willing to do it and is a very public face for it is a good idea. Like, someone like Alvaro Arbeloa is not going to be able to eat the sins the way that Jose Mourinho is. Jose Mourinho can come in and be the bad guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And that way, if he's just like, you guys don't defend. Like, if I were Florentino Perez, I'd be like, man, if they don't defend, bench them. Like, I don't care, man. Bench them. But if it comes right down to it, I do need Mbappe and, you know, like, Bellingham to be happy. Like, that's kind of what I need. Everybody else, Vinicius question mark, but basically everybody else not that bothered about it. And I'd be like, we need to win trophies, man, so if that's what it takes. And if at the end of a year everyone's like, get Jose Mourinho the fuck out of here, then you're like, great, doesn't matter, because at least we had, you know, the uncomfortable conversations. Yeah. And you blame Mourinho,
but that kind of cuts both ways, though, in that, yes, okay, he can be the bad guy, he's very good at being the bad guy, he's very comfortable with being a dick. And
they should walk out to that, by the way. That should be their walkout music. That'd be so good.
But the whole point is that they're resetting and doing this big, hit the big red button, is that they want to win, or they need to win something big very soon. And if you look at Mourinho's tenure, has he been good since, what, pre-Man United? Like, what, Benfica, Fenerbahce, Roma, Spurs, United, Chelsea Mark II, Madrid. Those were his last, whatever, 7 or so, going back 13 years, 16 years until...
So the question, like, is he good at any more, is an open question. On the other hand...
For the last 10 years, he's been very, very questionable managerial reigns.
They're going to be in the title hunt regardless. Like, last season, okay, Barcelona got 94 points, which is crazy. But Real Madrid, who we were like, these guys are dog shit all season long, they got 86 points. Like, I know that sounds like a big margin, but it's kind of not really, right? You get a couple of results in El Clasico, and Barcelona are probably due a bit of a drop off because you tend to get that after a while with Hansi Flick.
I mean, they also scored 20 goals less, almost 18 goals less.
Yeah, but that's always the case. Like, but and the defense can get a lot better for Real Madrid, but that is a closable gap anyway. And I mean, I agree that I would not want Mourinho. His recent work has not been good. I haven't enjoyed him since, I would say, his second season at Manchester United. I think post that he's been pretty bad.
Was that the season we finished second?
It was the season. There was one really good season in there. Yeah. Actually, he kind of got United going quite well. And then he got a couple of trophies in the first season. And then there was still some good stuff in the second season, but it was already tailing off. And then he was gone. And I didn't like him at Spurs. I didn't like him at Roma.
I've not liked
Roma,
him since United. And even that was questionable.
Non-job. He's just like not a guy anymore, but in any serious way.
I have time for Mourinho, I guess, still. Just maybe it's roasted the glasses of what he was 15 years ago. What he was in the mid-2000s. But I think this is such a huge risk and a huge ask of Mourinho as well. If the key KPI of his employment is to win a major trophy within, what, 2 seasons? Like, well, to win La Liga or the Champions League, I think that's a huge ask. If Mourinho is the second coming of Mourinho is the big reset that Real Madrid need, I think it's a big ask. I think it's a big ask considering he's been out in the wilderness success-wise in terms of, or high-quality managerial-wise. He's been out in the wilderness for a decade.
I do think La Liga is quite winnable. I do. But the Champions League is kind of not for Real Madrid, I don't think. Like, I would be stunned if Real Madrid were serious contenders to the Champions League, even if they keep Vinny, even if they sign Rodri. Like, because, I mean, then it's totally possible. I wouldn't be stunned, I guess. Like, it's totally possible that you can make a great team out of those guys, but I don't trust Mourinho to do it, and I don't know if they can defend, and we'll come on to that later. Mm. And you look at a team like Arsenal last season were comfortably the best team in England, were the best team in the world for probably half the season, before they started to tail off. And they came up against a much more complete team in the Champions League final in PSG. And then there's Bayern as well, who I think are really quite good. And then you look at the Premier League next season. And yeah, there are lots of question marks, you know, like because Liverpool are going to be in a period of transition. And I think their top level is probably going to be good, but their centre back's a bit question mark. Like Man City, not quite sure what they're going to look like. Like there are questions, but there are a bunch of teams in the Champions League next year who would be problems for Real Madrid. Real Madrid would not be automatic favourites over them. And as a result, the odds are just against you winning the Champions League. Whereas at least in the league, it's going to be a 2.5-way fight. Like I quite like the stuff that Atleti are doing in the window. So who knows? But basically, you got to hope that you get luckier than Barcelona on injuries and stuff. And I think that's probably quite possible.
Yeah. I mean, Atleti have a good run once every 8 seasons, basically. Like a properly good run.
And they are signing like Kang In Lee, for example, is cool. But anyway, like, I mean, at Madrid, the problem is that Madrid is not just like, here's a completely functional squad and all you've got to do is slap it together and get them pulling in the same direction. There are significant tactical concerns there, right? So they have wanted a cross replacement. Like that is what they've been talking about. I think they thought that Trent could do it a bit, but they obviously don't. They're not really sure about Trent. Like, fundamentally, they just liked what they had for 10 years and they want to do that again. So, Kroos gone, Modric gone. They want that guy in midfield. Defense is a real problem because, like, you can't really press and pin teams in with these guys. You know, they did it actually really well under Xabi Alonso very briefly and then everyone hated it. But you also can't really defend deep because those guys aren't going to track back and help out their fullbacks. And your fullbacks now are like Denzel Dumfries and Cucurella. You've got a squad that is just like kind of strangely built now. Like we'll talk a bit about some of the players who might lose out under Mourinho, but it's a big dressing room with a lot of well-paid, highly rated players, and it'd be very easy to piss them off. And then of course, you know, there's this Vinicius Mbappe thing, which is still going on. And it's not like disastrous, obviously. Like Vinicius is still great. Mbappe is still great. I wonder if maybe Vinicius's numbers have taken a bit of a tumble because Mbappe's in his spot. But these are issues to solve. And Carlo Ancelotti, who is a very good problem solver, was not able to figure out a way to put all this stuff together. So the idea that Mourinho is going to do it, I think, is a bit concerning, even if he is helped by like the application of loads of money.
Ancelotti is probably the manager. If anybody could do that, I would say Ancelotti's best place to do it.
Yeah. Ancelotti, Luis Enrique, like these guys are, even before Luis Enrique went to PSG, we talked about him as like, he is this kind of problem solving manager. Like Tuchel is kind of this as well, where he's going to come in, look what he's got and try and figure out something practical to make it work.
Whereas with Mourinho, I think Mourinho comes in and he implements structures that defensively solid, compact, strong, like physical systems.
Yeah.
Not huge possession based, more kind of direct co-control directness over like a team that will have 62% possession on average across the season. I think he has adapted and modernized his football, but I do think he's still a stretch back from a manager who can tinker around with a system to find a solution. I think he's more plug and play. This is how I want to play football. This is what has worked for me, or this is how I've adapted what was amazing in the noughties to something that's, you know, reasonably functional and usable now. And these are the players and types of players I need to fill this system versus this is the system I'm going to build or tweak my system in this way to fit and fix these issues that are being caused by Mbappe and Vinicius wanting to operate in the exact same positions in the exact same areas of the pitch, and our entire attack being fully left-sided dominant and so asymmetrical and imbalanced. Like, if Ancelotti can't solve that, I don't see... And this is why, you know, for Vinicius's future could really be in question here. I don't see Hoy plugging Mourinho into this Madrid squad and him not just saying, okay, well, if, say, the front line is Vinicius, Mbappe and someone else, Hoy him, any way he sets up tactically and squad-wise, Vinicius off the left and Mbappe doesn't just cause the same, if not worse, problems than it did under Ancelotti, especially in games where you're coming up against quality in transition that you will in the Premier League, because in the Champions League, because it's one thing playing against fucking, I don't know, Espanyol or Osasuna week in, week out. It's another thing playing against, okay, yeah, Man City are in transition, but they also still have a very, very good squad or player individuals who are incredibly talented, way more so than 85%, 90% of what you'll meet week in, week out in the league. So I think there are huge question marks, and I just don't see, if the idea is Mourinho's going to come in and he's going to win us something in the first couple of years, something big, and he's going to do it with the stable of players that we've got by being really inventive and smart and problem-solving, I have huge questions about it.
So do I. I think Mourinho can still probably do quite well in some of the bigger games. I do think Mourinho is good at those sorts of adjustments still. I don't think that goes away. You know, coming up, but those are also games where the players are going to try.
Yeah.
You know, like if you are coming up against Man City, yeah, it's a tougher match, but that is a game where your team's actually just going to work a little bit harder. The problem's when you come up against sides who are beneath your level, but not that far beneath your level. You know, like when you have to play like Aston Villa in the Champions League, for example, Real Madrid are going to be like, fuck Aston Villa. We'll go out there and like blow their doors off. That's the kind of team that'll fuck you up if half your guys are just like ambling around, not doing anything like that. That's a problem. So, I mean, they've obviously gone and done a lot of signings this summer, like Cucurella we talked about, Konate. I think Konate is really good. Cucurella, yeah. Too old, has been in decline. Don't love it. Like, but
he's quite Mourinho-y. Mourinho-y,
though. He's completely fine.
Yeah, and he had a good World Cup as well. He looked good. And also,
Mourinho does tend to like to have one attacking fullback, right?
Yeah.
And it looks like it'll be Denzel Dumfries. Denzel Dumfries is like going to be the fucking Ivanovic here. Mm. And so having Cucurella there, who has played as an inverted fullback, as a wing back, as a fullback, as a left-sided centre back in a three, like having him there is pretty helpful. Like, he can make a kind of back three with the guys you've got when you're in possession, and that's going to work fine.
So wait, you think Dumfries starts over Trent with Cucurella on the left?
Yeah,
because that's the thing. If he wants, yeah,
I think so. I can't see Mourinho liking Trent.
he's not a very Mourinho player.
All things are possible, you know, because like Mourinho liked Ozil, but not a right back. Sure. I just don't think he'll like him. I think Dumfries is not that good. Dumfries is old now. I've never really liked the player. Like, he's just very specific. And he worked when he was playing as a right wing back, but he doesn't really work, I think, as a proper right back because he's not a good defender and he wants to just get forward in attack.
But that's fine if you plug in Cucurella, who's like swings sure. in as a, almost like a left-sided centre-back at points.
Well, and also, you know, if basically you are going to have over-occupation of the left-hand side with Vinicius and Mbappe, having Diomande and Dumfries on the right-hand side, well, Diomande doesn't really make sense there. Like, you'd be better off having Endrick there because Diomande needs to get on the ball to do stuff. Actually, the weakest part of Diomande's game at the moment is his off-ball attacking runs. You know, that is a thing he is not good at, and his shot numbers are really low.
He's so young, though.
Yeah. But that's
shit you can learn. But again,
mate, it is stuff you can learn. I'm not denying it's stuff you can learn, but it's shot numbers do tend to pop quite young, and it's weird that he's not really shooting more. But he's also about to go to a super team, so who knows? But you know, having Dumfries and another off-ball runner pop up off the right, whether it's Rodrigo, Brahim Diaz, Endrick, like whoever's fit, like that kind of makes a bit more sense. But you can kind of see how the idea is that you'll get a bit more danger at the right-hand side. Then he's got Bernardo Silva, who's in. Okay, like, fine.
Yeah,
bit of experience.
It's depth, right? It's just a player.
And a bit of the Kroos thing. When they've talked about Kroos, they obviously, you know, people imagine them talking about the quarterback, right? Like the guy who's really like spraying passes and can pretty much do attacking passing from the base of midfield. But Bernardo does help you with a lot of the other Kroos stuff, which is tempo setting, like real tempo setting.
Metronomic stuff, yeah.
Yeah, like, we're winning the game. We are going to pass it around for half an hour, and you're going to have to press us and come and get it off us. Mm-hmm. And all the time that you're doing that, we're going to be seeing if we can spring Mbappe over the top. Like, Bernardo is a perfect, like, on-pitch brain to have.
Yeah.
So those are the guys who are in. Then we've got Diomande. So we might as well talk about Diomande because he's, you know, it's been here we go'd, right? It's going to be...
Oh, has 100... I missed that?
I think so.
But I knew, last time I checked, it was basically done. It was like everything was ticking towards being like, okay, it's ironing out the absolute final details. We're within 10 million euro valuation here, so we'll land somewhere.
You knew it was going to get that. But so it's 100 million euro fixed, I think, plus 20 to 30 in bonuses. You know, PSG obviously out of the game. So like Real Madrid are literally the only team in the world probably who can bigfoot PSG right now. But Diomande is coming in, 19 years old, really good season in the Bundesliga last year. Like, honestly, first season, like, he's a kid.
Crazy.
And it's like Ousmane Dembele, right? Like, Ousmane Dembele goes for rent, he goes to Dortmund, and he's off.
Yeah.
Didn't go that well. But anyway, he paid a lot, and he's an interesting, like, Spencer Mossman, this guy was talking about him on Twitter, and they have, like, a kind of value added per 90, like, metric. And he said, the three best teenage winger seasons of the last 5 years, according to this metric, are number one, Lamine Yamal last season. Number two, Yann Diomande last season. Number three, Lamine Yamal the season before. You know? Yeah. So it's like...
pretty rarefied air.
That's the level that they see him playing at. What do you think about him as a kind of fit? Or like, what's... do you want to kind of go over the kind of player he is? Because I still think that a lot of people listening have probably not seen him play that much outside the World Cup.
I think he's... a hugely attractive prospect for his age. His sample size is small because he basically has had one season, but he is literally 19 years old, so it's kind of hard to beat him with that stick when he was literally a child a season and a half ago. But last season was fantastic. He had 20 goal involvements in the Bundesliga, 28-90s, under 28-90s. No Bundesliga player attempted more dribbles last season. I had the highest dribble success rate among European wingers with at least 50 take-on attempts last season. Fifth fastest player in the Bundesliga. So these are all things that are pointing toward a good, dynamic, ball-carrying, wide player. He's physical, he's fast, he's not afraid to take players on. He does so at a good, successful clip. Good with both feet, fast, excellent acceleration from a standing start. That helps massively in transition and counter-attacks. Like this, he's got a lot of the attributes that you look at a player and think, okay, this guy could be huge in 4 years. But the thing is, with the season last season, he was actually huge last season. You know, 20 goal involvements in the season. My issues come, or my concerns come, with the scenario that he'll be used in. Who will be with him, or who he might be replacing. Mm-hmm. Or will he be supplementing, or will he be replacing? Because he can play on either flank, which is great. But there are a lot of similarities between him and Vinicius Jr. And there was a metric that The Athletic used that actually said that he was over a 99% profile match for Vinicius Jr., which is good because Vinicius Jr. is a great player. My issue is, are they bringing him in the thought that he will replace Vinicius Jr.? Because then I get concerned because I think he's great. I think he has a high ceiling. I think he's had a very, very good season, but also was very, very small sample size. The risk with him coming in and plugging him in as like a like-for-like replacement with Vinicius is that this guy's 19. This guy's had one season in the Bundesliga. This guy is by far a worse player than Vinicius is. And that's not knocking Diomande. That's because Diomande is a literal child. Diomande could be better than Vinicius when Diomande is 27. But we have no idea. That's almost 10. That's 8 years away. So while he's had a very, very good season in the Bundesliga, expecting him to come in, if the expectation is for him to come in and replace Vinicius and for Real Madrid to be as good or better than they were last season, I think that's a stretch because Vinicius is a proven peak age player who is experienced and has the know-how and ability to regularly change big games, show up in the big moments and say, you know what, I am going to win this game on my own in this moment. I'm going to take charge here and be like, this is football matches are won on moments. Vinicius has proven time and time again to be capable of stepping up at big moments and winning big games. Diamande, you cannot expect him to do that regularly, certainly not at the same rate as Vinicius. So that's my main concern. If the idea is we're probably going to have to shift on Vinicius to make the squad more kind of symmetrical and stable and balanced and left and less left centric. But if the idea is to then just plug in Diamande and be like, okay, go and do Vinicius things and have Vinicius's output, yeah. I have real concerns. I think replacing Diamande with Vinicius on the left would arguably make Madrid more balanced and functional. Certainly yeah. easier to stop counters and better pressing team, less vulnerable in transition, more balanced, more functional, but considerably less dangerous and less reliably dangerous as well in those kind of moments where you just need a bit of brilliance from one of the best players in the world, and that is Vinicius Jr. So it is a real double-edged sword if, you know, the idea is Vinicius leaves and Diamande gets plugged in at left, it would be Mbappe on the left, Endrick probably through the middle, and Diamande on the right if Vinicius leaves. Yeah. Like that would probably be the way it
yeah,
works.
Yeah, I don't think there's a world where Diamande no. is playing lots yeah. of minutes on the left. But yes. like, though, I have questions about that as well. Like, I mean, I think, yeah, it's the same thing. You know, is it going to be Diamande and Vinny or Diamande replacing Vinny? Like, exactly the same thing. Like, he's an amazing prospect. He's great right now. He's replacing a guy who has made the difference for Real Madrid a lot.
Yeah.
Especially in the Champions League. And Diamande could go on to become an amazing winger and still not be at that level. You know, he could be really, really good, but not be at that level. And the things about putting Mbappe on the left as well is just like, Mbappe can kind of do everything. But firstly, you've got to put a weaker player in the 11, right? You've got to go and put somebody in the other position if Mbappe goes left. So somebody comes in at striker. And I love Endrick, but like, if you can have Vinny, Mbappe, Diamande, that's better than Mbappe, Endrick, Diamande. The other thing is that
as a forward line, yes, but not as a functional first line of defense.
Yeah, sure. But like, I'm talking about attack though.
Sure.
And the other thing is though that Mbappe, I don't really want him really out wide, right? Like,
I mean, he's going to drift, right?
Yeah, but you certainly don't want him out on the touchline. He's much, when he dribbles, Mbappe is much more of like a push and go dribbler than Vinny is. And so if you actually end up with him out on the touchline a lot, he's a guy you can double cover out of a game out there. Not entirely. Like, there are always going to be moments where he gets away, but it's not like Vinicius Jr. who can just dribble around three guys. Like, that is actually not really the kind of player Mbappe is.
You're saying
like,
he needs space to run in. He needs space to move into as opposed to running down seemingly close channels.
Yeah, I think that you have Mbappe as your left winger. You actually, he occupies the left too much to play with a left winger, but he doesn't necessarily occupy the left enough to be the left winger sometimes.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I'm not saying it's a big problem, but like,
but I kind of think if you play him off the left, he just kind of stays left-ish because he wants to drift inside anyway. So I think he'll be
sure.
He won't be. Which
but
I
if Kukure, but if Kukure is hanging,
who's
if Kukure is yeah. hanging back and Mbappe is drifting in, suddenly you get the opposite of what you've had the last couple of years, where suddenly like everything's happening on the right and there's nobody out on the left. Like, that is a little bit of a worry. But the other thing, of course, is that if Vinny does go, you do have the opportunity to make your attack better out of possession.
Oh,
you know,
sure.
Like, then you only need to carry Mbappe. And it's quite easy to see a situation where even if Mbappe's starting on the left, he's the striker in the press.
In the press,
you know,
yeah.
And somebody else peels out to the left and does the dirty
work. He's
a
traffic cone at the top.
Yeah. And then you have Endrick or whoever it is, Bellingham, I don't know, who cares? Like, going out to the left, and that's their job. So there are a lot of kind of like slight trade-offs here. I do think that Vinny Diamande goes a long way to fixing some of the problems with Mourinho. Like, Mourinho
Vinny and Diamande together?
Yes. Mourinho didn't really evolve his attacking ideas. You know, like, he carried on wanting to play the defensive way he had before, and teams have got better at attacking, and he didn't really get better at attacking. But you've got two elite one-on-one guys who can both create, and Vinicius can get shots. it's kind of hard to shut those guys down. Like the attack is going to be good if you've got both of those guys. So that helps a lot with Mourinho, because you don't need a manager figuring out loads of fancy shit if his wingers can just beat whoever's in front of them.
Like, if the tactics like just get one of these guys the ball and see what happens.
Yeah. Look, we spent a lot of time on Diomande there. Rodri also looks like that might happen. That's a bit of a risk too. Injuries, blah, blah, blah. As you've said, like, Rodri is like a possession guy.
Yeah.
And he would be coming into a manager who, like, when you look at Mourinho's first stint at Real Madrid, it was like 55, 54% possession, like that kind of thing. Like, it's not super ball dominant. On the other hand, like, Rodri, I do think, works with all the personnel they've got. Like, Tchouaméni can play as a more mobile kind of eight. He's done that quite a bit in the past. That's obviously what Valverde wants to do. Camavinga can do that. Like, all those guys can pair with Rodri, and that can work fine. Again, my worry is, like, what happens in big games? Can this midfield hold up with no protection from the attackers in front of them? Because you don't want to be pressing high, really, and asking Rodri to cover loads of ground, especially when you don't have very good pressing forwards. But if you want to defend deep, then okay, suddenly, you know, Rodri's not a problem in the middle of the park, but your wingers aren't tracking back and helping out the fullbacks. This is scary stuff. So when I look at it, I just ended up thinking, like, is the idea here Jude Bellingham is going to fix it all? Like, Jude Bellingham playing as a
10.
Well, Jude Bellingham playing as a 10 is much more of a midfielder than a regular 10, right?
Yeah. It's an 8/10 type.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can play Bellingham as a 10 and you get loads of value from his box crashing. And also he can be the guy who goes and occupies the box. Like, when you're in possession, you could have a situation where Bellingham gets into the box and basically plays as the 9. And meanwhile, Vinicius, Mbappe and Diomande all have license to kind of interchange behind him.
Yeah.
That would be quite scary and interesting, I think. But out of possession, I think the idea is Bellingham is huge. Bellingham is intelligent. He'll work really hard. Maybe Bellingham is just going to be the guy who, like, basically steams around like Declan Rice and thunders into challenges and, like, sorts everything out. But Bellingham also has, you know, his issues out of possession too. So, I mean, looking at the squad looks pretty great.
Yeah.
Like, it's very deep. Like, it's got lots of good players, lots of good players, like, of different types as well. Some of those are going to go, like, Mastantuono is going to go out on loan. Tchouaméni's been linked with a move away, but I don't think that'll happen.
No.
Bernardo was actually already linked with a move away. There was talk that Real Madrid were going to immediately sell him, but don't think it's going to happen. Asensio's going to go. Mendy's injured, blah, blah, blah. But I guess what stands out to you as a concern with how they're going to set up? Because to me, there are a few obvious worries looking at this squad. Like, there are players I'm worried for.
So I think there are selection issues here. Selection, like, things I'm interested to see what Mourinho decides on. One of the main ones being, like, the involvement of Rodri. I guess if you're going out and getting him at this age, the plan is for him to play, at least play a substantial amount and feature a substantial amount. The issue I see have seen for a while with Real Madrid's central midfield stable is that there's a lot of them and they're all really quite good. And there isn't enough positions for them to fill. We saw Camavinga demoted to left back under Ancelotti just to get him on the pitch because he couldn't get enough minutes to centre midfield because of Valverde and Tchouaméni. So adding Rodri in there means that if you're going to pair him, say Bellingham is going to be the 10, hypothetically speaking, then that means you've got one position to fill and you've got to choose between Valverde, who's in line for club captaincy, I think, Tchouaméni and Camavinga. Mm-hmm. And there's already been beef and multiple points last season between Valverde and Tchouaméni. I don't know what that's about, but I can't imagine that them both now directly, or even more so than before, competing for minutes will help that. And I guess it's a nice problem to have, having so many good central midfielders. But I have concerns about the dressing room, like, morale when Tchouaméni, who played like 3,200 minutes last season, if he's somebody who falls foul of Rodri coming and the starting lineup is actually all of a sudden Rodri, Valverde, Bellingham. That's the midfield three. If you're Tchouaméni, who is a fantastic player, and you're sitting on the bench for two-thirds of the season, coming on in sub-minutes, playing in the cups, whatever, I wouldn't be very happy with that. So there's a lot of man management there with that. Rodri's obviously old, and we don't know how his body's going to hold up with obviously the ACL injury and the hamstring injury last year as well. Like, there could be a lot of rotation there with him, I guess. But yeah. Also, you know, there's a lot of unknowns there. And also, we're assuming here that Bellingham is the chosen number 10. And for many reasons, that makes sense, like you just said. But probably definitely makes the most sense, in my opinion. But that also means you've got Bernardo as depth, which is fine. That was probably what he was signed for and expected to do. But then you've got Arda Güler. Where does he fit in this? If you've got a box-crashing Bellingham and you've got like more traditional, direct, athletic wingers in Vinicius, Mbappe, or Diamande, depending on whatever they start the season with. Arda Güler is then a weird kind of off-cut who doesn't really fit. He should be playing 10. He played 10 in the preseason game when it was him and the kids and everybody is still at the World Cup. But I have questions about who he chooses or what he does with Arda Güler if his choice is, Mourinho's choice is Bellingham is our number 10 and he's going to be this kind of 8/10/box-crashing guy who's just going to be a physical force in midfield, because Arda Güler is not that at all. So yeah. I guess he offers tactical flexibility or a different option there. But again, this is a guy who's too good and he's now getting too old to still be playing this kind of like 17-year-old role where it's like, we'll call on you in little moments of games where we need you, where we think you can make an impact. It'll be great if you know you can play X amount of minutes a season. That'll be really good for you in your development. He's getting too old and he's too good to be getting the scraps. So I have concerns for him. Trent, other concerns. You know, it is a straight shootout between Trent and Dumfries, who is the starting right back. I guess this is less of a concern for me because I think you can be more tactically flexible with that based on game scenario. Who is better for the game? Do we want to run? Is this a game where we can run progression through Trent up from right back? If it is, then sure, play him. Is it a game where we need a bit more of a athletic, physical guy, right back getting forward, acting kind of like helping out whoever's up there, then play Dumfries? I think that's actually, Trent is obviously such a class player, and there was this whole ordeal to get him, and it was like they'd courted him for so many years, and also it would be a bit funny to see him like demoted to second string so quickly. But I'm less concerned about this. I think both of them will play a decent amount of minutes next year if they're both fit. And then the other concerns are literally just the forward line. Who is there? What is there? Who's available? What composition is it? How does it work if we have Vinny Mbappe Diamande? How does it work if you have Mbappe Diamande plus one other? Those are my main kind of selection concerns based on the squad that we kind of have at the minute and could be there at the start of the season.
Yeah, I think the midfield is fine. There are lots of minutes to go around, and I think Rodri, you know, is obviously starting the season with an injury as well. Like, yeah, I think Rodri, he'll get rested a lot for like Champions League games and stuff. So you can totally imagine them running out, you know, Valverde, Rodri against, you know, Man City, and then running out Camavinga, Tchouaméni in the league the next week, and that's kind of fine. I think Bellingham is going to be the 10.
He kind of has to be, right?
I just think that there's going to be a load of pressure, obviously, to play him, but I also think Mourinho will love him. I agree about Güler. Güler concerns me because I think he's super talented, but the only times that Mourinho has used a guy like that in a deeper role, you know, like Pogba or Cesc, he's played them alongside somebody who's like a defensive monster, and Rodri is obviously not that now. And even as like a kind of traditional passing 10, like Ozil, like Mourinho hasn't really used those guys that much as well, you know?
Yeah.
Like he likes, you know, when you think about Mourinho 10s, Ozil's in there, and then people like Oscar, he kind of often likes people who work really hard and are a bit more midfieldery than you'd expect, because that's what Oscar was. Oscar worked really, really hard and was not like he is the hub of everything that happens in the final third. You know, Mourinho sold Mata when he was at Chelsea as well. Yeah. Like, so
After he'd won the Premier League player or Chelsea's player of the season 2 years in a row.
Yeah.
Mourinho sold him.
And so I think, you know, they're not going to chuck Güler out the door immediately, and I do think that he'll get minutes there. But I look at him and I'm like, well, you're not going to play deep in midfield. I don't think you're going to play on the right. I think you're going to be the backup 10.
Yeah, he's going to get like 1,300 minutes max in the league.
Because even on the right, you're like, I can see Mourinho using Bernardo with Dumfries providing the width before he's, you know, dropping Goulaire out there. So that's a bit of a concern for me. The other problem is Endrick. Because I love Endrick. He needs a lot of minutes. Mourinho has never liked this kind of striker. Like, even in the last few years, like Benfica, Pavlidis, Roma, Tammy Abraham, Andrea Belotti, like, he likes big guys who are problems for centre-backs in the box. He does not like nippy little dribblers who like to go and pull out wide as his centre-forward. Like, he just doesn't do that. He is always, so often whenever he's arrived at a club, the first thing he's done is said, we need to bring in a big physical centre-forward type, whether it's Zlatan Ibrahimovic or Diego Costa or Andrea Belotti, you know, whatever. Like, he has always liked that kind of player. So you're kind of hoping that he looks at Bellingham and says, well, Bellingham's the 10, but he's going to give me that. You're hoping that that's the solution Mourinho gets. Because otherwise,
well, who else does he choose?
Otherwise he's going to say, right, okay, well, we're going to use Gonzalo Garcia, we're going to go out and we're going to buy.
Sure, they're going to buy someone, yeah.
Just somebody, you know, maybe we're going to go out and buy somebody who's like, maybe a bit older, kind of 31, 32, who can give us a year or two of like fairly traditional centre forward play. And by then, Jose Mourinho would have left. So,
yeah.
So there are a lot of questions there. And yeah, I mean, Trent, God knows. But you're right. You know, they've got a couple of centre backs. If Militao comes back and gets completely fit, then I would really worry for Trent. Like, then Trent might go. And there's still the part of me that thinks,
I know, he's such a good passer, though.
In a year, do we see Trent go to Man City? Like, is that what happens in a year? Mm. Or to Bayern Munich? You know, like, does he just go somewhere else? That's my question that's been floating around with Trent for a while. Anyway, is there anything else you want to say, or should we get onto the bone? But like basically, I think Mourinho is not what he was. This is a guy who was attacking one of your key players, like, very recently, for the temerity to be racially assaulted. He is a divisive character. He has had a chip on his shoulder now for a long time. He does not protect his players. The players are not going to protect him because they don't give a fuck about anything. The players have, you know, everybody says, oh, the players won't be happy, you know, not winning trophies. Like, I guess that's true, but the players are clearly happier not trying and not winning trophies than they would be trying and potentially winning trophies. Otherwise, they'd be trying. Like, they don't give a shit. They're perfectly content to just, like, do what they can get away with. But I do think that Rodri, Konate, like, these are useful signings. I think they're likely to improve them. I think they've still got a good shot domestically, just because I think the wheels are due to come off Barcelona at some point. And Rafinha was in and out last season. Obviously, Lewandowski's gone. Don't know what the centre-forward setup's going to be. Is it just going to be Ferran? I don't know. Don't love the Gordon signing. I think it's okay. it's a weird fit for Barca.
Fucking Gil Platt playing left wing.
Adeyemi, good player, but also slightly weird fit. Yeah, I don't know. So I think that the league is totally plausible. But to me, Mourinho's not even there. I was going to say he's there for a good time, not a long time. He's not there for a good time. He's there for a bad time.
Yeah.
He's just there for a bad short time. Yeah. That's my take on it. All right, burn book time. Let's open up the burn book. Pete, what should we do? Where are we going to start? In, out, you, me. Wow, sounded quite suggestive.
Proposition. See, I was going to say shake it all about, because I've recently been spending time at Bonnie's music class.
Sure.
Doing the hooky cookie. Do you want to start with what you're taking out of the burn book?
Sure. So, everybody needs a little hobby, I think, that's relaxing. I don't mean ones where you really have to concentrate, you know, like there are hobbies where you kind of think, I actually can't listen to a podcast or something while I'm doing this because I'll just forget that I'm listening to it and an hour will pass. And, you know, like if you're painting or like I've done some woodwork in the past and like you just can't do woodwork and listen to an audiobook. You can't do it. You've got to concentrate too much. But a nice little hobby that's kind of brainless and very gratifying, I think, is good to have. And I recently have found myself watching a lot of videos on Instagram of people cleaning leather objects, cleaning leather shoes, cleaning leather bags. There's a whole subculture, by the way, of people who just like collect Coach bags. and restore them and then get really angry with each other about using the wrong products. They're like, that's actually too drying for a coach bag, like all that kind of stuff. But I find it very satisfying to watch because like leather is one of those things that it can look white, crunchy, patchy, cracked, yeah, fucked up, and you can give it a clean, condition it, and it will look amazing. Like I have Blundstone boots and the toe of that, they're black, and the toe of them had kind of turned green. And I was like, man, shit, like they're just wearing away, like because I wear them too much. Okay. Like, and I just thought, I'm going to have to get them recolored or something, or that'll be the end of them if they're actually wearing down. I gave them a clean. I put on some leather conditioner. They went pure black again. They're amazing. Like, it's such a satisfying thing to do. So I've been doing this recently. I've invested in some slightly better leather like products. And then I, as I like to do, bought some horse bit woven loafers.
Interesting.
Off Vinted. And I was like, what these brand? Are really good. These Bally. These okay. are the, this is a Swiss shoe brand for people not acquainted. You know, like they're in good condition. They're in really good condition, but they are just in need of a bit of TLC. Like everything's fine about them structurally, but they just need to be looked after. And I was like, great, that's what I want. So I've got them in, clean them up with some pH balanced leather cleaner, adding some conditioner, you massage it in. If they've got brass, you know, you check if the brass is pure brass or whether it's, you know, steel coated with brass. You do that with a magnet and then you use Brasso or something to just like polish it up a bit. And suddenly, you know, genuinely these shoes can look brand new. I also found Emma's old Marc Jacobs bag. Like Emma bought herself a Marc Jacobs bag asked for a Marc Jacobs bag as like her going away to uni present from her parents or something.
Sure.
And, she used to carry it, you know, every day for like 10 years. And then at a certain point stopped. And I found it in the loft recently. And I was like, I just really want to clean it. And it's very meditative to sit there and like scrub away at it and very quickly get a gratifying outcome.
Yeah.
Like, so anyway, this is something that I'm enjoying at the moment. And also I think I've always been very interested in materials. Like, for example, I don't know that much about architecture. But I do really like tactile materials in architecture. I think that my interest in clothes often revolves a lot around like fabric more than, texture. You know, color or anything like that. And so this leather cleaning really appeals to that part of me where it's just like very nice to kind of get to grips with the leather because I really love leather and suede as fabrics. And so, yeah, that is a sad fun thing that I've been doing lately.
There is like a subgenre of video games that kind of lean into this same area. So
I got advertised a game recently that was like you pressure washing
literally what I'm about to reference, not the Star Wars part, but a person I work with, they came into work last week and they turned him in and they were like, have you ever played like this pressure washing game? Have you heard of this? And I was like, no, I've not heard of this. And they were like, yeah, I've just basically started playing on the PS5, this game where all you do is you just have a list of things that you need to go and pressure wash or you need to clean. And you just go and you just pressure wash them. You just knock off the list and you need to like complete it 100%. And cool. That's it. And it's just like this real, like you say, meditative, this disengaging, this kind of like reset thing where you actually doesn't take any real significant mental bandwidth. You just kind of operate without thinking. And it's such a difference to the rest of life where you're like constantly thinking about everything and having to do what you need to do, all that stuff. This is, you're just literally staring at a screen made with a fake pressure washer, cleaning a digital fucking barn or a car or in whatever case you saw Star Wars figurines.
I completely get it. You know, like someday, like I, before we got on this call, I was on a website looking at a pressure washer in my basket, just being like, do I want to just pressure wash the garden?
Yeah,
I don't know. Like, I kind of do. After I've done that, what do I do with the pressure washer? Nothing. There's no need for me to own a pressure washer. But it's very appealing.
You need to do it
like,
every year.
I sorted the loft recently as well. I mean, I've got very little left to do. But my loft has had boxes in it. Like, not crazy number, but it still had boxes in it from when we moved in.
Unopened, and like unsorted?
Opened, but like unsorted. So the odd thing had been pulled out. But it was great because I could go to Emma and say, you don't want any of this shit. And the way I know is that you haven't touched it since we moved in, which was 2.5 years ago. So fuck this stuff. It's all going. And just going through that, I found actually also very gratifying. I was like, put my headphones in, and just like sorted stuff, chucked stuff until it all looked good. And now the loft is just like a much nicer place to be. Which is obviously good when we've got guests. It's also good because I spend so much time in here working. So yeah, I think finding a little job like that, that you find satisfying, you know, because I hate fucking like emptying the dishwasher.
Mm.
But these jobs I really enjoy doing. And it's also kind of a nice act of love as well. Like you can give somebody their bag and be like, oh, hey, I clean this for you. Like when it got to, I don't know, April or whatever, and Emma and I both kind of put away our Chelsea boots for the 3 months of a year we don't wear them, and then before we take them out again, I got Emma's and I cleaned them and I conditioned them,
mm-hmm.
because I know that she won't, and I like doing it. And then she like is delighted about it, even though I'm doing it at least partially for myself.
Yeah,
like because I enjoy it. But it is nice to say to somebody, "Hey, I did this for you." So yeah. Yeah, I recommend it. And you, and also the good thing about leather cleaning is you need very little. Like I found that I had like 4 horsehair brushes just lying around the house because, you know, you somehow inherit them or yeah. sometimes
you get them when you buy things.
I've got yeah. two. I've got two that I just got with pairs of shoes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just kind of thought, why not? I'm going to try and do this more. And it's actually kind of sparked a desire in me to find really fucked up leather goods secondhand. You know, that people are selling cheaply because they're like, oh, this bag's
like the start of a TikTok page.
Yeah, I know. I'm just like trying to find things that are the right level of fucked up, you know, where I don't have to try and like change the soul of something.
Yeah.
But yeah, you buy, I was thinking, oh, I'll happily buy a leather bag that they say, oh, there's a water stain on it, so I don't like to use it anymore. And I think I can actually get that water stain out and then I'll just give it to somebody as a present. I think that's quite fun. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I'm taking out. What are you taking out?
What I'm taking out of the burn book this week are linen shirts.
Yeah, so big time. Wearing one as we speak.
I used to be a big shirt guy, like 10 years ago, 10 plus years ago. But like that kind of era shirts, you know, the skinny jeans, Ralph Lauren shirt, suede Chelsea bits or something. You know, like very, very sure. 2014, 2015, 2016. Very era appropriate. And then kind of when I moved to London, I moved to more like t-shirts with overshirts. And like the casual shirt kind of fell away from my wardrobe for quite a while. But this summer has been atrociously hot so far, or at least the last like 4 or 5 weeks have been atrociously hot. So layering just isn't an option. And when it's pushing like close to 40 degrees in central London, like even linen trousers are pushing it at points. So then you're kind of left, or at least I was left with t-shirts and shorts, which is fine. But I find it very like boring and one-dimensional. For me, because I basically only wear like minimalist one color t-shirts, like single color t-shirts, basic tee. For me, it's like the base of an outfit that you build around. So the more interesting part of your outfit are the top you put on top of this t-shirt, or the trousers you wear with the t-shirt. I find there's more limits with shorts, because part of this is me, because like I refuse to wade into the waters of the jorts. I'm more interested in the world of like the short shorts and the kind of like high-low nature of athletic shorts with kind of paired with slightly fancier, more formal wear. I'm more interested in that. I do think it is...
You're mescal maxing.
So I enjoy the idea. I think functionally, I have questions and concerns about me doing that as a 35-year-old man, especially going into work with short shorts. I just don't think that's a thing. So I think there are limitations to that, and it's something that I've thought about, but it's not something that I've actioned or come close to actioning recently. Whereas like if I was wearing a nice pair of pleated linen trousers, it immediately just, and you tuck it in like a white t-shirt, the outfit becomes more of an outfit immediately. Whereas if you're just wearing like standard shorts with a white t-shirt. So I find it more limiting. But I then decided to get back into linen shirts, and without really any effort, just throwing on a linen shirt over a t-shirt with shorts makes that outfit that look basic and simple and like, you know, oh, it's like the fucking clothes we send Bonnie to nursery in and put a little pair of shorts and a random t-shirt, right? It turns that outfit into something that just immediately looks so much more complete and well thought out, when the reality is like you've just got your color palettes right and your patterns right. There's no class there. As long as you've covered those two things, you can throw on a basic pair of shorts and a decent linen shirt and your outfit will just look so much more well thought out than it will be if you're wearing like just a basic t-shirt. And there's way more range as well. You can wear it with loafers, You can wear that outfit with loafers, you can wear it with trainers, you can wear it with Bostons. Whereas I think like standard shorts and a white t-shirt with white socks and loafers, I think is a bit more of a stretch. But if you swap out that t-shirt for like a blousy, billowy linen shirt, choose however many buttons you wish to put, you know, you can go deep V if you wish, but it just works so much better, and it looks just like a more curated outfit, like a more consciously curated outfit. I think it's quite difficult to really sell just simple shorts and t-shirt, and also it's linen, like it is more breathable than cotton t-shirts, and also a lot of the cotton t-shirts I wear are like quite heavy cotton t-shirts as well. So yeah, it's better in the weather, it looks better, and you can iron it a bit, but it kind of creases fine. Like creases within linen is completely fine. It's expected within reason. It doesn't need to be like perfectly ironed. You can just run an iron quickly over it, roll the sleeves up, have, you know, the top two or three buttons undone, untucked. It's just like a kind of effortlessly achievable look that looks way more put together than it actually is. So I've ended up investing in like three or four linen shirts in the summer. And usually when they come out of the wash, they go on pretty quickly. Like they don't last long hanging up, because it's just so easy to, when it's like 35 degrees outside, 34 degrees, and you're commuting into London, throw on a pair of shorts, throw on a shirt, and you actually look reasonably put together without actually trying.
Yeah, the shirt as jacket thing is a really good move, I think. And like you say, it's kind of all you've got in the summer. Yeah, I would love to be one of those people who turns up with like a really cool fit even when it's hot, but I'm just, as soon as it becomes hot, you're right, I do just dress like a toddler. Yeah. I'm like, what do I put Goldie in? That's what I'm fucking wearing today. Like shorts, t-shirt, maybe a slightly more interesting shoe.
Yeah, but I think, yeah, I think interesting fashion comes from pairing interesting things together. When you're having to cross off things that are available to wear, your options are so limited. They're dwindling with every degree the heat increases. And when you're left with, I've got a t-shirt and shorts, at least with my wardrobe, I find it in quite limiting or quite difficult to make something that actually looks quite well put together. Like even yesterday or Tuesday or something, I chose black linen trousers over shorts, and I tucked the white t-shirt in and wore it with Adidas Gazelles that are like nude color almost. It's like suede nude. But because it was like the linen trousers were light, they're not pleated, but they kind of almost fold into a slight pleat, and it was tucked, so it was cinched at the waist. It looked so much more put together, and someone was like, oh, it's quite a cool outfit. But literally all it was a white t-shirt and black trousers. But I think it's so much more, it feels so much more of an outfit than if it was black, white t-shirt and standard black shorts. And I don't know what it is. I think maybe it's just the way trousers drape. I don't know. Yeah, I just put on shorts and t-shirt, and I just look at myself and I'm like, it's fine, and it's functional, but 80% of men in the world could wear this and it wouldn't look out of place. And I think that means that it's one, it's very safe, but two, it's not really going to turn any heads.
Yeah, I mean I know where you are with that. Okay, what into the burn book? Do you want to carry on with what you're putting?
Yeah,
in
I can
the
put it in the burn book. What I'm putting into the burn book, and I don't know if there'll be crossover, but what I'm putting into the burn book are traveling long distances with a small child. Now, I haven't had a truly bad experience yet. You know, only like the inconvenience, the stress and all that. We definitely are due a horrific turn of events. But we recently went to France, and that involved a 3-day wedding just outside Paris, and then driving down about 6 hours further to the house.
3-day wedding, jeez.
Yeah, it was like a French chateau. It was a pool party on the Friday and the Sunday, and the wedding on Saturday. Black tie wedding in 34 degree heat. Everything outside. No shade.
Oh my God.
She was warm. But even without the like catastrophic turn of events of all the horror stories you hear, just getting there. Just all the things you need to bring. Sorting everything out. Just getting out the door. All of the shit that you now need to do with a small baby. The list is so long. So the place we went to in Abbeville for the wedding, where we stayed in Airbnb, didn't have a travel cot, so we had to bring the travel cot. Okay, oh, so that's God. So we're driving, it's fine. So that's in the car. The week before we got to the house in France, it was 40 degrees in the area that the house is. House doesn't have aircon. Okay, that's not very good. So we had to bring the fucking aircon unit from our house to France. So
what?
So that's in the boot. And the car's a big car. Like, it's a Volvo. It's a saloon, so it's not the full dad wagon, but we had a roof box as well. So, like, we have a lot of space here. So we've got the travel car, the aircon, obviously all our clothes. My mum is coming back up from France to go back to Sheffield as we're coming down. So she meets us where we're staying in Abbeville so she can do a couple of nights babysitting so that we can, so two of the three nights we can stay out late. But she's going to come and pick her up on the wedding night. So,
okay, yeah.
We need the travel. We have two car seats, but the car seat in our car at the minute is like a big fucker that's fixed. It's like ISOFIX in. It's, you don't clip it out. It just stays in. So that's a bitch to move.
Those things, man, they're never fucking smooth as well.
But it's one that you put in and you don't touch it till the baby doesn't fit in anymore. So I'm not going to be putting that in the mum's car and then putting it back next morning. So we had to bring the other car seat, the old car seat we had, which is, you know, one that works with the one we use for taxis. It works with seatbelts and all that. So we've got a spare car seat, the air conditioning unit, the travel cot, all of our normal like stuff, all of this is before we even leave the house. And like the car is absolutely rammed, mostly with stuff just to accommodate Bonnie like existing. And that's before we've even left the house. Then leaving the house, departure times, they all need to revolve around like eating or sleeping for her. So it's like, when can we maximize time in the car if she's sleeping, all of that stuff. We need to leave before she needs a nap. She needs a nap at this time, so we need to be going, or she needs to, if we don't leave by this time, we can't get there until this time, which means she'll be late for her lunch. All of these like random considerations. So you do all that as well as trying to get like make the shuttle for a certain time. And you also then need to stop every 2 hours. Now, the longest day we did was 6 hours driving. That was on the way home. But 6 hours driving, if it was just me and Jess, I would probably do like a 4.5 hour stint, bang it out, stop for 30 minutes, get some food, do the other 2 hours. You would do it in 6 hours, 30 minutes, probably.
Sure.
With Bonnie, you need to stop every 2 hours. And those stops need to be like minimum 30 minutes. At least one of them, probably the first one, needs to be about an hour. So you're looking at another 2 hours on top of that. So your 6 hour journey turns into 8. And that's before you even consider like the song and dance shows that Jess has to put on in the back seat just to keep Bonnie entertained. And also like we had to ply her with various shows on our phone, which we don't really ever do. But you know, it's guerrilla warfare at that point, you know. All is fair.
You just gotta get through
like,
it.
Like you just gotta get to the next stop. And it's just all of this like effort that is just, it's just everything's just quite a bit more difficult to accommodate traveling that far with Bonnie. And obviously at the end it's totally worth it and it's amazing, but the act of doing it I could do without. And the reality is that from Calais to the house is like 10 hours driving, probably 9 hours driving total. So once you add in all of the stops every 2 hours, you're looking at like 14 plus hours, which you can't do in a day with a child. So that means you're then having to factor in overnight stays as well. And also, by the way, every place you stay that isn't the house that mum owns, you're looking at like two bedroom Airbnbs or big family rooms in hotels, like all of the expensive shit whereas you would have just stayed in like a standard double before.
Yeah.
Doesn't really work anymore, especially unless you want to go to bed at 8 p.m. and just or sit in the darkness in your hotel room in silence. If you want to like enjoy the evening, you kind of want a bit of space from Bonnie since she can like sleep somewhere that you won't wake her up when you go to bed. So there's all these things to consider and pay for. The expense is significantly more. And then that also means that it eats into your holiday. So we did the 3 day wedding. Then we drove down to the house, stopping overnight. So we didn't get to the house until the Tuesday late afternoon. And then because we were traveling the whole way back up to Calais and then Folkestone and then up to South London, we left on the Sunday, first thing Sunday morning, stayed overnight, 6 hours away from the house, and then drove the extra 3 hours on the Monday morning to the shuttle. So it meant that this whole trip to France that we usually do at the house for 2 weeks, we were there effectively. We got Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday as full days. God. And like obviously we had the wedding and it was great and the wedding was really, really good. But all of this driving with all of these stops and all of this accommodation, and we get basically 4 full days at the house. And it was really lovely, but we got to like the Friday evening and we're like, okay, it feels like our holiday is now starting and we're leaving on Sunday morning. We're leaving first thing Sunday morning. So it was great. I had a great time. Loved it. Would do it again, of course. But just the way things worked out, it just felt like we were it was a real pilgrimage, and the payoff at the end was like 4 days at the house in France and then back.
The drive, when you said 14 hours, like the fear that was in my soul.
Our neighbour has one in a similar scenario, but in Toulouse, another 2 hours further south, and they do it in one go. They have a 5-year-old and a 6-month-old, and they're going out in a couple of weeks. They're planning to do that in one just
kids can well kids out. Can get used to it, right? It's just like whether your kid will get used to it, and also whether you feel like it's fair, you know. Like for us, we're just like, that is a lot to ask of them.
Yeah,
you know. But yeah, I mean, we ended up, this is always the issue, you know, like Emma and I were talking about this, where we've got friends who don't have kids, and we look at their lives and we're like, objectively their lives are more glamorous than ours, and we could go and have slightly more glamorous holidays within reason. You're like, we don't have that much money, but like,
sure,
we could do that. But in order to have those more glamorous holidays, often you've got to sign away more at the beginning and the end of the holiday to get to where you want to go, and have a worse day of travel, you know, like a day where you do have to fly and have a stopover, or like, you know, fly and then afterwards get a train to a car, you know, whatever. Like it's a long palaver, or hire a car and like drive up into the mountains or something. Like there's, it can become so complicated. And after a while, you're like, well, the best way for me to get a holiday too is to try and get around that stuff as much as possible. And so that's why we ended up saying, you know, we are going to do things like city breaks, partially because it's a money thing, and partially because that is the way that we will not arrive on holiday wanting to like fucking walk into the sea. But
yeah,
it's hard work. It is hard work. Right. What I am taking out, in what I'm putting in the burn book, rather, classics in public. So I haven't got around to seeing The Odyssey yet. I was meant to go and see it today, but I was so fucking tired after sitting in the hospital all night, and you know, my fingers all fucked up, that I was like, Emma and I are gonna go and see it instead on my birthday next week. I was like, pretty cool, that'll be good, feel good about that. However, when I did a classics degree, I really didn't think that I was going to have to contend with it actually being relevant, you know? Everybody at the time was like, oh, what's that going to be relevant to? And you're just like, oh, fuck off, you dweeb. But like, in fact, it's fucking everywhere and it's annoying. Like, after I left uni, in the kind of 15 years since, there's obviously been like this big resurgence of retellings of classical myths. So you got Madeline Miller did The Song of Achilles and Circe. You got Pat Barker doing The Silence of the Girls. You've got A Thousand Ships by Natalie Haynes. You've got, like, often they're like quote unquote feminist retellings, right? It's like, who are the mistreated women of classical myth? We are going to reclaim them. And of course, you've got Emily Wilson's translation of The Odyssey, which was like controversial for lots of reasons. You've also had Stoicism becoming like a kind of public conversation. Now you've got obviously this Nolan movie, and then Emily Wilson, one of the translators of The Odyssey, like basically calling it shit online, and then people arguing about that, being like, well, she's not a film critic, what does she know? And people saying, well, like, yeah, but she went and saw the film, like she can say what she wants, and she does know the poem. And then other people saying, yeah, but this is also like a very poorly thought out piece of writing, like it's not a good piece of criticism. And other people kind of acting like you can't criticize her because she's a scholar in the area. Like, and it's just going round and round and round, and it's so fucking boring, man. I'm just like, I'm constantly hearing opinions about The Odyssey from people who don't really know anything about The Odyssey. Like, their knowledge of The Odyssey is based on like a children's translation of it they read when they were a kid. Not interested in that. I'm equally, though, not interested in hearing from scholars who think that the most important thing in an adaptation is that it be faithful. Like, that is not true. I had professors when I was at uni who would tell me with a completely straight face that Gladiator was a bad film. They were like, Gladiator is such a bad film. And I'm like, why? And they're like, because it's not accurate. And I was like, that's got nothing to do with whether it's good or not. That's got nothing to do with whether it's good or not. Like, that makes no sense. It's like saying at the end of fucking Inglourious Bastards, but Hitler didn't die like that, you know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, we know.
Yeah.
But wouldn't it have been good if he did?
Yeah.
It's an opportunity for interpretation. And actually, as a translator, Emily Wilson knows that. She knows that her translation of The Odyssey is also an act of interpretation. She also knows that the texts that we have of The Odyssey would have gone around for years in many, many different forms before eventually it was set down. And at a certain point, we decided that that was the canonical version of the Odyssey.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
But it would have been amended, forgotten, changed, written down, argued over. And eventually, like, at a certain point, we're like, no, no, this is the right version.
Yeah.
But what makes it the right version? We just kind of decided that. So the idea, therefore, that, like, changing anything about it is some sort of act of vandalism is just, like, ridiculous.
Yeah.
And that's why we don't get people like that to weigh in, because they can't see the wood for the trees. Anyway, seeing people, like, lecture each other about classics, seeing, like, idiot racists who think they know something about classics because, like, they've read Marcus Aurelius's Wikipedia page, talking about how it's actually bad that, like, Lupita Nyong'o is playing Helen of Troy. I'm like, bro, just say that you're a racist. Just say that you're racist. Like, just come straight
say
out and
be I
like,
don't like the fact
you just come out
black.
And be like, yeah, just say, like, I don't find black women attractive because I'm a racist. Like, just yeah. just say that. Yeah. Rather than doing all this, like, mental gymnastics to be like, oh, this would have made no sense at the time. They would have actually prized pale skin. Like, shut the fuck up. Everybody knows that and nobody cares. Like, none of that shit matters. Don't care. If you're an expert, I'll listen to you a little bit, but I still, at a certain point, I'm going to say, is the film good or not?
Yeah.
Does the film engage me? If a film is 3 hours long and it keeps me engaged the whole time, that's a successful film.
Mm.
Like, that is the truth. Fuck off with this.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, I found it very annoying, and I'd quite like it to end this conversation. But I will see The Odyssey next week. I'm perfectly happy now to wait. In a way, I'm kind of now hoping that we're getting further away from the discourse.
What's your take on IMAX versus not IMAX, and how everyone's rimming IMAX about The Odyssey and Nolan?
This is the first time that I was kind of like, I would like to see it in IMAX. But then you look at the bookings, you're like, nope. I guess I'm not going to see it in IMAX.
I went on the BFI and I was like, I was literally out.
Yeah.
And it was sold out. It was sold out so far before I even went on. And
so
apparently resale
said,
going
go,
for like
go and see ET at the BFI South Bank on my
So the same person who told me about pressure washing, they saw last week in IMAX in somewhere near Bedford, and they booked on day. So If you want to travel, like, up to somewhere near Bedford, that option is available.
I've got to be honest, I don't know where the fuck Bedford is.
Like pretty north
okay.
of London. Their commute is like an hour and a half.
I don't go north of
each way. So like they commute for 3 hours a day to go into the office.
Sounds normal. It's just not possible. But I think, I don't know, like, Nolan at least, like, actually does shoot things for IMAX, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
In the past, there were often films where they were like, well, we have adapted this for IMAX, so go and watch it in IMAX. It's the same way that James Cameron was directing things for 3D when he did it with Avatar.
Mm.
And you're like, that's a very different experience to, like, when they slap a couple of scenes in a thing just so that they can call it 3D and charge you more. Like, those are different. So I'm okay with it. I would have liked to have seen it in IMAX, but I'll see it next week, and then maybe I'll try and see it in IMAX, like, later in the year. But if that's the way the director wants it to be seen, it's going to be the best experience. And so if you want, like, try and go and see it that way. I'm just not fighting through a booking system so that I can sit in a packed auditorium full of, like, not to put too fine a point on it, annoying farmyard cunts, like grazing away. Fuck that. I'm going to go and see it at the Curzon, where there are three other people in attendance. And one of them's my wife, and it's going to fucking rock. Like, every time I go, the most people I've ever had in that Curzon with me is like 8. It's fucking legit. It's so good. So now I'm like, what will actually make for a better experience? That's a pretty small cinema. The screen will take up the entirety of my vision. I'm pretty certain it will feel good, even if it isn't, you know, real IMAX. The other thing about IMAX is, like, when you actually do end up going to IMAX, you always end up, like, in some fucking insane seat, like, absolutely miles from everything. Like, one of the side seats or whatever, and then you're like, why am I here? Like, I could have just seen this at the normal cinema. Anyway. Look, we've overrun, as normal, so we're going to get out of here and go on to the paid episode. We'll catch a bunch of you over there. Please do subscribe if you don't already. We really do appreciate it. Send in your questions, please. We're running thin on the ground, as always. We know that it's been a long time since our previous episode due to our clashing schedules, but hopefully we'll be back on track now. And in the next month, we've got transfer window going crazy. We've got the Premier League season will be starting again, like in the third week of August. Loads of shit's going on. The transfer stories are insane. So come along with us for the ride. We'll see you next time. Bye.